Jesus sends out the 72, and this is again Luke 10, 1 to 9. After this, the Lord appointed 22 others and sent them two by two ahead of him to every town and place where he was about to go. He told them, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into his harvest field. Go, I am sending you out like lambs among wolves. Do not take a purse or bag or sandals, and do not greet anyone on the road. When you enter a house, first say, 'Peace to this house.' If someone who promotes peace is there, your peace will rest on them. If not, it will return to you. Stay there, eating and drinking whatever they give you, for the worker deserves his wages. Do not move around from house to house. When you enter a town and are welcomed, eat what is offered to you. Heal the sick who are there and tell them, 'The kingdom of God has come near to you.'"
As hopefully most of you know, we've been talking for a long time about this upcoming evangelism series, and today is the first day. We want to make this as practical as possible. So before I start, I'm actually going to show you a couple of resources that are brilliant if any of you want to do some extra reading around the topic. This book here, How to Talk About Jesus Without Being That Guy, is really good. Sam Chan, and I will be referencing him in this sermon. I'm not going to lend you my copy because I still need it, but this is a really great book and accessible and very like normal when it comes to evangelism. And then the other thing, which some of you will probably have but may not have read, is this Ripe for Harvest evangelistic magazine. Shame on me, I only started reading this when I was preparing for the sermon, even though I got it last year. It's a very, really good magazine that's put out by our own diocese. There's a couple of copies on the back table that if you don't have one, you're welcome to take. But if you've got this sitting on your coffee table and you haven't read it, I would encourage you to dip into it because it's got some great stuff in it. For many of us, though, when we think about evangelism, it starts to kind of evoke this fear in us. I don't know about you, but sometimes, well, actually, a while ago, if someone asked me about evangelism, how did I feel about evangelism, I kind of get this tight feeling in my chest and kind of a bit of an eye twitch and want to avoid the conversation. Many people who love Jesus actually feel quite incapable, incompetent. They feel like a deer in headlights, like evangelism. I'll do everything else that Jesus asked me to do, but evangelism, we'll save that to the evangelists. Who else is in the same boat? Maybe you've had a bad experience of trying to share your faith and it went horribly wrong, or maybe you had someone try and evangelize you and it was just awkward and like you just couldn't wait to get away. Maybe you just strike yourself off immediately when we talk about evangelism, and you'd actually just like to walk out right now, but everyone's seeing you and will know why you're walking out, so you're not going to. Some of you think that you have to be able to download the entirety of the systematic theology to someone, and that's what evangelism is. The world is against us. They don't want to know anyway. Why would I put myself out there? Well, my very first experience of evangelism did not go very well. My parents, I don't remember this, mercifully, but my parents told me that when I was four, I was very good friends with the neighbour next door, and mum and dad were friends with those parents as well. And they were really good friends. They'd kind of do stuff together, or they'd chat over the fence, and then they noticed, mum and dad noticed that things had gone quite quiet, and they kind of weren't interacting with mum and dad anymore. And in fact, things were getting quite cold and frosty, and mum was like, "What's going on?" So she walked over next door, and started talking to them, and they discovered that I and my black and white four-year-old self had gone over and proclaimed to them that my mum had said that if they didn't believe in Jesus, they were going to hell. Now, I'm quite confident mum wouldn't have said that to me, but in my four-year-old, you know, four-year-olds say, I've got a four-year-old, I know what they say. So fair to say there was a bit of repair work for mum and dad to have to do. That is not good evangelism, and I have learnt a few things about evangelism since then, thank goodness. Is anyone else really hot? Can we turn that one down? I'm just beginning to like I feel like I'm going to have a hot sweat up here. And that's not evangelism. And Michael, you can edit this bit out of the recording, right? Right, so a lot of what I have to say today is from a guy called Tim Pierce. He's from Melbourne. And he identifies that many of us assume that to be an evangelist is to find the nearest unsuspecting victim, I mean friend, and steer the conversation from whatever you're talking about that's normal into Jesus. You download the entire doctrine of substitutionary atonement and the four spiritual laws, and then you expect to get a conversion on the spot. That's what many of us, whether we like it or not, sometimes think evangelism is. And that's not evangelism. That's trauma. That's traumatic for every party involved. And I think we sometimes feel discouraged, don't we? Because some of us have had bad experiences. Some of us don't know how to do it. Like I said before, some of us feel like we're not smart enough. And it does feel awkward. And so we're in this place where, as Christians, we know God's called us all to the Great Commission, but we don't know how to do it. And so it's kind of like that, we'll park it for another day. Well, we're not parking it for another day. We're going to address it this term, which is really exciting. So what do? We don't just leave it for the gifted people. We don't just leave it for those people who seem to have a... I've met some of these people who you would call a gifted evangelism, because there is a gift of evangelism given. And they seem to be able to walk into a room full of people ignoring all the social cues and manage to talk about Jesus. And part of me like cringes inside, then the other part of me is like, man, I want to be able to do that. I wish people didn't care about me enough. I mean, I wish I didn't care about what people think about me enough to be able to do that. I admire those people, but I would have to have a personality change to be able to do that. Anyone else with me on that? Yeah. But if you're like the rest of us who kind of feel like a deer in headlights when it comes to evangelism, or we just want to kind of run for cover, or feel like we need a personality transplant, I've got some hopefully helpful tips for us today. And the first thing is to tell us that we're actually all called to do this. For those of you who were at Bishop Jay's talk at West Hamilton Combined Service a few months ago, he spoke about the fact that none of us are off the hook when it comes to evangelism. We are all called to the Great Commission. We are all commanded as followers of Jesus to do this work of introducing people to Jesus. And that's really all evangelism is. It doesn't have to be more complicated than that. It is introducing people, those we love, those who are around us, those who God puts in our path, introducing them to the person of Jesus. But some of us need some help. Some of us need to see how it's doable. We need to have the PTSD taken away of evangelism. And we need to get some practical ways that we can do this. I'm in the same boat as you guys are, or I was in the same boat. I went to a Christian school. Here's another story for you. I went to a Christian school, and we had an outreach team. As if going to Christian school wasn't enough, but then we had the outreach team, and that was for the uber Christians. And the outreach team, when I was there, was led by a very short but very excitable man. And he would kind of personify the typical evangelist that you can think of that you don't want to be. He would jump up and down at all these crazy things in the name of evangelism, like street preaching and all of these other awkward things. And I remember thinking, that was my bad experience. I didn't want anything to do with evangelism after that. And I know Mum and Dad are smiling because they know who he was. Now, who knows? I'm sure lots of people came to Christ through him. He probably was a great evangelist, but for me, that was traumatic. So this term, as we dig into unpacking evangelism, we're going to look at the fact that it is very practical, and we're going to be as practical as possible. So I hope you do have your pens and paper. We're going to be as normal as possible. You don't have to have a personality change. You can be you. We're going to share stories. We're going to hear lots of stories. If you've got a story where you have helped introduce someone to Christ, whether they made a decision or not, whether you simply were able to talk about it and you think that it would benefit the rest of our congregation, please come and tell me so we can share stories. We're all in this together. We want to encourage each other and demystify this whole thing. So that's what we're doing this term. And we are going to have a few things as well as our Sunday sermons. So we're going to have a workshop. I'm still working on securing down the person who's going to do it. I know who they are, but we just need to get a date. They're going to come and do some really practical things. And we're also going to have an evangelistic course at the beginning of next term that we can be working towards to invite them, similar to Alpha. We'll let you know more as we come along. And the other thing that we need to remember is this is not a box-ticking exercise. We are not doing evangelism at a church just so we can, yep, we've done that. We've done that season. Now we're going to go and do something else. We're actually wanting to become a culture of evangelists. This is part of us. This is who we are as a church. We are a praying church, and we are a church who share our faith, who love other people around us, and we want to show them, we want to introduce people around us to Jesus. So let me tell you another story about the first person I helped towards finding Jesus in a much less damaging way than when I was 4. In my second year of university, I became friends with a girl called Lauren. So I was in vet school, and sometimes I still wonder how the heck I got in. It must have been an accident, or maybe there was a switch in the transcripts, but somehow I ended up finding myself in this cohort of very intelligent people. And there were some of us, you know, kind of, we scraped in, but then the majority of them were very, very intelligent. They were the kind of people who were probably ducks at school. They knew the periodic table by the time they were 2. And Lauren was one of these people. She was super smart, and I just felt so dumb around her all the time. But she was super lovely, and she is still super lovely, and we're still very good friends. But she was not at all interested in Christianity, or at least that's what I thought. Her parents, one of them was an ardent atheist, and the other parent was right into spiritual, New Age spirituality, and was kind of taught Reiki and yoga and all of that kind of thing. So that was her background. And as we studied together, she would occasionally ask me the odd question about faith, because she knew I was a Christian. And in fourth year, she started asking me a lot about it, asked me a lot of questions that I simply didn't have the answers for. I didn't know how to defend my faith. I didn't know how to argue it, and I felt like she was kind of trying to disprove me. And I vividly remember a car trip home one night after class in her green Mitsubishi Mirage, which really was just like a tin can on wheels. And I felt like in the car ride home, she was totally grilling me in all sorts of things to do with God. Like, why do you believe this? And what about this? And I actually walked in the door, and I felt like I'd had a round of machine gun bullets to my chest when it came to defending my faith. And I remember standing in the kitchen thinking, if that girl's the last person on earth who's going to become a Christian. Like, she's just so anti it, and I'm so useless at defending my faith or even arguing for it. If I was to put bets on all of my 90 classmates, she's going to be the very last person who would come to faith. I just felt totally inadequate in explaining my faith. And to some extent, it was a good exercise for me, because I'd grown up in a Christian home, and I'd never really thought about exactly why I believed. I'd never done any apologetics or thought about theology. I just kind of believed, and most of it was through experience and some good teaching. But so it was a really good experience for me. It made me actually think a bit more deeply about my faith in an intellectual level. But suffice to say, I did a terrible job, I'm sure, of explaining my faith to her. And in fifth year, she moved into our flat, and we became flatmates. I kept listening to her questions, and I kept engaging in conversation, even though it was like, kind of, what am I going to get shot at about next? Allowing her to grill me and just doing life with her. So at this point, we've been friends for 4 years, okay? 4 years. And then one night, an astounding thing happened. She came out into the kitchen one morning, and she said, I became a Christian last night. She had given her life to Jesus. Not with me. She'd just knelt down at the side of her bed and decided she was going to make a commitment to Jesus privately. No one was more surprised than me. But wow, how amazing was that? And I've learned some really important things through that experience. We don't have to know all the answers. We don't have to have all the theology straight before we can start telling people about Jesus. We simply need to love people. We simply need to share our lives with people. We need to be able to enter into conversations with them, even if it gets awkward and feels like, oh, I don't know. We're just introducing them to the person of Jesus, and we know Jesus, and they can't argue that away from you. And that's where we start with evangelism. And the other powerful thing I learned is that God's always at work first, even when we can't see it. Like I said, I had bets that she would not become a Christian, but God was working in her. And he does all the work. He just invites us to join him in it. We don't bring people to Jesus. He does. We simply need to introduce them to him and play whatever part he asks us to do. But the actual onus is on him. And we are all uniquely placed and uniquely formed in our personalities, in our friendship circles, in our hobbies, in our families. Whatever personality you have, you have a unique position to be able to share the love of Jesus to someone. Let's turn to Luke 10 again, and let's read how this fits in. So after the Lord appointed the 72 others and sent them two by two ahead of them to every town and place where he was about to go, he told them, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few." So at this point, Jesus has been talking about the cost of discipleship and with his followers. And then he sends the 72 out to preach and teach the good news of the gospel ahead of where he's going to go. And he says, every town and every place. The harvest is plentiful and the workers are few. Now, I don't know about you, but often I have thought, hey, God's got this wrong. The harvest is nothing. I feel like there is no one around who's hungry for the Lord. And we, the church, we're relatively plentiful. I mean, in New Zealand, we are diminishing, or it feels like we're diminishing, but it feels like we're all keen to lead people to Christ, but actually no one's interested. God, you've got those words wrong. And often, you know, we heard John Corbin a couple of weeks ago. Seems like the harvest is plentiful where he is, in his circles, right? He said there were 500,000 people coming to Christ each week around the globe. Isn't that amazing? 500,000 people. That's 72,000 a day. 72,000 people in this world are coming to faith. So Jesus has got it right. The harvest is plentiful. But not in my neighbourhood. You haven't seen my colleagues. You don't know my extended family or my family. You don't know the sorts of places where I have friends. No, the harvest is not plentiful. Well, if we won't grapple with the statement and believe the words of Jesus, then everything's up for question, right? If Jesus says the harvest is plentiful, then we need to take these words seriously and say, Lord, where is the harvest plentiful? Show me where it is. Jesus said these words to his disciples in a society that openly persecuted him and chased his followers out of town. They stoned his followers. The Roman occupation and oppression was not exactly a walk in the park. And Jesus, if Jesus says the harvest is plentiful in that day and age, and then the church totally exploded when you look at church history, then he wasn't wrong. God is still at work in our world today. And our job is to see where he's at work and to join him in it. I think some of us are guilty, actually, for prejudging people. We think, like I did with Lauren, oh, those people, they're not interested. We assume awkwardness is closed and resistant. But sometimes there is an awkwardness. There's an awkwardness in many conversations we have about life. It's not always about faith that things get awkward. But awkward doesn't mean closed. I felt totally awkward most of the times I had conversations with Lauren. Little did I know, she was actually really open and she was seeking. And it took a long time for me to stop being defensive and defeatist and to realise God's actually working in her life. And he was inviting me to join him in the work of revealing himself to her. Gosh, what a privilege it was. So how do we see where God's at work and join him in it? Because I don't know about you, but that feels a whole lot more lighter on your shoulders than I've got to go and find some people and bring them to the Lord and it's all on me and if I stuff it up, then they're going to go to hell. No, do you know what? God is bigger than that. Salvation is on him, not on you. We just get to play the part and that's what's so exciting. So I've got three evangelistic tools for us today to put in our evangelistic toolbox. As we wipe the slate clean, as we put the PTSD and the traumatic experiences to the side, and I would encourage you to do that, we need to then pick up some tools. So the first thing to do is to be authentically curious. The best posture for evangelism is to have an authentic curiosity. You don't have to say smart things, as I proved to myself with Lauren. You don't have to be able to answer every question. Just ask another question. Answer their question with another question. Find out more. Find out why they believe what they're saying. Ask them, where are they coming from with that question? Jesus did that, didn't he? Often the Pharisees would set out to trap him, and he turned around and asked them another question. Use the pressure to ask a better question. Ask them to tell you more. Ask them to tell you why they think what they do. Ask them to tell you their story. We live in a world that has a pandemic of loneliness. People are so lonely because no one asks anyone about anyone else anymore. People are desperate for someone else to hear their story. People are desperate for people to hear where they're at. Some of you will have met my friend Heather. She's an authentically curious person. She has this fantastic ability to ask questions of people that she's interested in without being threatening. So she's curious and caring. She'll meet people in all sorts of random places, and she's thought through the questions, so she's got a bunch in her back pocket, and she's the one I'm hoping to get us to come down and do a workshop on this. But she will ask questions that open people up, and it's non-threatening, and it's just so interesting to see how you can ask one question and people open up and asking. She's a really great person at doing that. But when we ask people about who they are and what's going on for them, we're inviting them into relationship with you, and then that's the best basis for evangelism. When I asked Lauren later what it was that had convinced her to come to faith, obviously it had not been me able to answer her questions or to be smart or to win an argument over her. There was nothing I said which convinced her of the gospel from memory. She said, well, I just met you and you were normal. Like, I'd met lots of Christians before, but you were like the first normal one I'd met. I hope I'm still normal. You were fun. I went to the pub with them and had one drink. They all got blotto, but I went with them and had a drink and just socialised with them. It was just normal. I didn't know that was evangelism, but anyway, now I do. I didn't have a personality transplant. I was just me being her friend, asking her questions, hearing her story, and that's what opened her heart to faith. And obviously God did a lot more other stuff. But I did my part and God did the rest, and I was normal about it. Second half of verse 2. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into his harvest field. And this is the second tool for your evangelistic box. It's prayer. Lord, where are you already at work? Where are you already working in people's lives? Ask the Lord of the harvest, meaning pray. The Lord, you can say to him, Lord, I don't believe you that the harvest is here. I really don't. But help me to believe. Help me to see where you're working and help me to believe what you say, that the harvest is plentiful. Show me where you're working. And you know, God cares more about the harvest than even we do. If we knew how much he cares about the lost coming to know him, our heads would explode. He died for them, right? He put down his life for them. He is at work long before we are. And if this means what it says it means, the harvest is so plentiful that us workers are going to be scrambling to help. We're going to be overwhelmed. So our prayers should be, God, show us where you are and send out your church. Mobilize us to cope with the harvest. Help us see where you're working and equip us. Send out the workers to where the harvest is. And, you know, John Corbin's talk was all about that. They're scrambling to get pastors and teachers for all of these people who are coming to faith. And then we read this, this is verse 3, go, I am sending you out like lambs among wolves. Do not take a purse or bag or sandals, and do not greet anyone on the road. Now this lambs among wolves imagery references Old Testament prophetic writings, and it refers to the vulnerability that we place ourselves in when we go out. It's not lambs to slaughter, which is good. It's not going to be a bloodbath when you go and share your faith at this point in our country, in this part of the world, but lambs among wolves. We are in a place of vulnerability when we share our faith. We need the Lord to help us. We are dependent on the Lord. We need him to guide us, and we need him to supply all we need. This is why we don't take a purse or bag or sandals, which are the things we normally rely on. And metaphorically, that might mean we don't take a polished theological argument. We don't take all the answers in our back pocket or anything else that we might automatically trust in. We don't need to have everything with us before we can start evangelizing. It's great to know apologetics and it's great to know theology, but that's not what is going to convince people to know Jesus. It is going to take risk and trust. It's risky to steer the conversation towards Jesus, isn't it? But it's totally worth it. And the worst case scenario, as Tim Pierce says, they say no. And the sun will still rise the next day. And if you've been polite and normal about it, they won't strike you off as a friend. They'll just be like, oh well, that's something they're passionate, that's them. And as Jesus says later on in the text, shake the dust off your feet and move on. And that's okay. God, keep praying for them, but maybe God's got someone else to do that journey with. But sometimes when you take a risk, wow, you find people of peace. You find the people you probably prejudged actually are slightly open to the gospel. I told you I was going to tell you lots of stories, and here's another one. Last year, I ended up as chairperson on our preschool board. Long story for another time, but how I came about doing that. But I sensed that God was at work in it, and it was something more than just being a chairperson, but I didn't kind of really know anything more about it. So I did it, and I, for my first meeting, I'd been to a few meetings before, and I saw that they all started with a karakia. They were praying in Māori, or the chairperson prayed in Māori to the gods, and that's how they started their meeting. So I thought, I might jump in on that tradition. So I did that, but I prayed in English. I explained that I didn't have any Te Reo prayers with me. I personally didn't feel comfortable doing one, but I was going to open with a karakia in English, and I prayed to the one true God. It was a risk. I was a lamb amongst wolves. I basically just prayed to our God and asked for his wisdom as we led the meeting and his blessing on everyone. And that was it, really. I wasn't downloading the doctrine of substitutionary atonement to them all. I wasn't telling them all about, you know, all of that other stuff. I just simply prayed a blessing. I took one little step. And then when I went to close the meeting, I almost closed without another karakia because I was like, one was enough. And someone said, oh, are you going to close in prayer? Close in a karakia? I was like, okay, yep, sure. Did another one. And out of that one little act, which felt very risky, I had several conversations with people that resulted in talking about Jesus. I asked people individually later, was that a bit uncomfortable for you when I did a karakia in English? These were my responses. There were four people I asked. One person really liked it and wanted me to go and bless the preschool. They're not a Christian. I know that. That's what they wanted. Another person said, oh, they went to a church for a very long time, but now they're wanting to get back into it. Another person said they grew up Anglican and it, you know, that was for back then. They weren't interested now, but, you know, they didn't feel uncomfortable. Oh, that's good. And the fourth person said her nana used to go to church and she'd been thinking about wanting to go to church because her kids had been asking her questions, but she didn't really know how to go about it. But now she knew that there was someone who was a Christian and so she wanted to know how she could come to church and know about the Bible. And I had a three-hour coffee with her about 2 weeks later and I shared the entire gospel with her because she wanted to know. Now, if I hadn't taken that one risky step of praying, and it was only a small step, I wouldn't have had those conversations. If I had prejudged and presumed they would all be closed and not done it, who knows what would have happened? God is already at work. We just need help seeing it. And often, the little step we have to take is just a little step. 99% of the time, it's just a little step. It's not a massive leap. Verse 5, when you enter a house, first say, peace to this house. If someone who promotes peace is there, then your peace will rest on them. If not, it will return to you. Stay there eating and drinking whatever they give you, for the worker deserves his wages. Do not move around from house to house. When you enter a town and are welcomed, eat what is offered to you. heal the sick who are there and tell them the kingdom of God has come near to you. The third piece for your toolkit today is find the people of peace. Someone who promotes peace is not necessarily like someone with a peaceful disposition, but someone who in their heart God has already started to work and they are oriented in the right kind of posture towards God. There's somewhere where God is already beginning to break into their hearts. He's already at work and he's calling you to join him in that work. And this is where you are invited to join him. Now, evangelism is not formulaic because it involves real people. We're all different. The way relationships go are all very different. But Tim Pierce says he's found three ways to identify the people of peace. This might resonate with you, it might not, but it's helpful to pay attention to three things he said. He's noticed that the people of peace are those who like you, they listen to you, and they want to serve you. Let me explain these. It's simple. People who like you, well, they like you. Kind of no more complicated than that. They want to hang out with you. They kind of, you ask them for a coffee and they come. That's cool. That's the first thing. The second thing, they listen to you. They talk with you about things. They ask your opinion on things. It might be the latest parenting crisis they're going through or the latest retirement issue that they're wanting to kind of nut out or the latest time they went fishing and they needed help doing this and what should they do? You know, people who are willing to enter in that kind of relationship with you, they like you and they listen to you. And they respect you pretty much. You know, if they're asking your opinion, they respect you. Maybe you've got someone in your life who comes to you for advice. Maybe there's someone who might actually also be interested in hearing what you might have to say when they're having their midlife crisis or when things are going wrong. Maybe you could ask them a question like, oh, so what's your spirituality? Or how do you feel about kind of the end of life? Or I don't know, whatever it is, just pray about it. And these might be the people who are people of peace. And a final sign of people looking for a people of peace is to let them serve you. Jesus says, stay there eating and drinking whatever they give you. When you enter a town and are welcomed, eat what is offered to you. So let them serve you. Now the middle class British influence in us says, oh no, I can't possibly accept help from anyone until I'm absolutely desperate and I can't actually even get out of bed. We can do it all on our own. We don't need help. We don't need any help. Well, self-sufficiency kills community and it kills evangelism. Jesus says, let them serve you. When we allow them to serve us, it deepens a friendship and allows us to then serve them. Sam Chan, the guy who wrote that book, says one of my favorite, we ask our neighbors for favors because we've found that perhaps counterintuitively, you can build more relational trust by asking for a favour. By asking for a favour, we make ourselves vulnerable. We have placed ourselves in their debt. It's a funny way to earn trust, but it works. And slowly we've found that our neighbours were happy to ask favours from us in return. So if someone offers you something and you don't need it, but you think it might be a way to build a relationship with them, accept it. Put away your British pride and, you know, let them serve you. And you might find something happens. It's how community works and how evangelism works. If they've offered to bring you a meal and you really don't need it because you have five in the freezer, but they're offering you a meal, accept it with thanks. If you're having trouble with your kids and you just really need one of them to be looked after for a day and you think they might like to have your child, ask them a favour, and then they will ask you in return. If you've invited them for dinner, and you know really you can do it all on your own, this is the one I struggle with, and they offer to bring a plate, let them bring a plate. As we close, let me summarise by way of giving you some homework for this week. Ask the Lord to help you put aside the past traumas of your experience with evangelism. I've called it e-trauma, evangelism trauma. Your feelings of inadequacy, your feelings of hopelessness, the fact that you don't know enough. If you love Jesus, that's enough. And allow yourself to be normal, okay? tell yourself you don't have to have personality change. Adopt a posture of being authentically curious. Think of some questions that you might have in your back pocket for that moment when you feel you might have a good chance to ask someone a question, but you're not quite sure what you might ask them. Have a think about it. And as I say, we are going to do a workshop on that. Start praying to the Lord. Lord, where is the harvest plentiful? Where are you already working so that I can join you in that work? And Lord, equip us. Equip me. Help me to think of those questions. Help me to be bold enough to take that little step. Start with prayer. Pay attention to the people of peace. I've acronymed it POP. Pay attention to the people of peace. Some of you might actually have people springing to mind as I'm talking about this. Someone who you know likes you, who listens to you, and they already serve you, or they kind of, you want to have that relationship where you help each other out. Pay attention to those people and invest in them. So love everyone. God asks us to love everyone in our world, but we can choose who we invest in. Invest in the people of peace. Invest in the people that God is showing you who is coming, who he is already working. Pray for them. Pray that the Lord would start to change their hearts, would start to open them up, would give you opportunities to talk with them, to show them who Jesus is. Maybe it's just when you see them next, instead of hurrying off to do what you have to do, taking just a couple more minutes to enter into conversation with them and ask them a few more questions about how are you doing? What are you going through at the moment? Maybe it's making a priority to meet with them for a coffee instead of your best friend. So that's your homework for this week. And next week we're going to launch into 1 Thessalonians and we're going to look at how Paul took this call to evangelism seriously. And it was so fruitful that the church was born in Thessalonica. So let's pray. Father God, we thank you that you are Lord of the harvest and you care so much about the people in this world who don't know you, that you will do everything to bring them to you. And yet, Lord, you invite us to join you in that work. And how beautiful and special and what a privilege it is. But Lord, many of us feel a bit freaked out about it. Lord, we ask that you would help us to reset what evangelism means. And help us to see where you are at work in the lives of the people around us. Give us a passion to pray for those people. Give us endurance to keep praying for those people. And Lord, would you soften their hearts? Soften their hearts that they might come to know who you are. Thank you, Jesus. We're going to remain in a posture of prayer while Graham comes to lead us in intercessory prayer.